If you realize you're emotionally dysregulated, does that help you be less emotionally dysregulated? Which is a really good question that I wanted to know the answer to.
Neurodivergent sensory experiences are wild.
All we do, like most of the week, is think about ways to make things work better with ADHD.
Taking the time to identify a plan before you try jumping in is just going to make executing that plan so much easier. I think it's wrong, is what I'm saying.
You're calling them out. Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of the ADHD Research Recap. Today, we have two very interesting papers looking at varying stages of emotional dysregulation, which, as we know, is something that we struggle with a lot when it comes to ADHD. So very excited to dive into some of the research that's coming out about this topic and get a sense of what they recommend that we should do and the insights that they have. So the first paper we have is looking at whether emotion-related impulsivity is related to specific ADHD symptoms. Essentially, is there a relationship between ADHD hyperactive or ADHD inattentive, which used to be called ADD, and emotion-related impulsivity? So the way that people are dealing with impulsivity. It's from our old friend, the Journal of Attention Disorders. And I'm going to let Sarah explain it a little bit because there was a lot of acronyms, a lot of different pieces here.
There were so many letters. I think I'm just going to start at the top with all of the terms. The glossary here is really going to help give us a picture of what they're looking at. So emotion-related impulsivity is sort of an action that results, you know, from an emotion. So an emotion mm-hmm. triggers some kind of response. Mm-hmm. And they conceptualize that in terms of pervasive influence of feelings. Now, these are those internalizing symptoms. So sort of when the emotions affect your internal mental state. And then they were also looking at how feelings can trigger actions. So that's externalizing symptoms. So that's sort of like when your feelings are directed outward, you know, when you're breaking rules, perhaps a little bit of aggression. So externalizing mm-hmm. symptoms is sort of when feelings get directed outward, and internalizing symptoms are when feelings are directed inward.
Yeah. We'll talk a little bit more about this in the future because it is interesting to note which ones are more likely to be picked up by other people. You know, those externalizing symptoms, like you said, rule breaking, getting angry, storming out, these are going to be external, but the internal ones are in some ways much more interesting because they're maybe the ones that we haven't really talked about as a society until more recently.
Mm-hmm. Sort of the one we feel we have less resources for oftentimes.
Yeah, 100%, 100%. And then they had inattention and hyperactivity. Those were the other two.
Yeah, so basically they took their sample of 364 participants. They were all adults, predominantly female sample, about 70%. They all went through sort of a structured interview, you know, and then they completed various self-report measures. There was one on your tendency to have internalizing versus externalizing symptoms. You know, there was those ADHD related scales. And then there was also a scale specifically to measure whether you tended to act out or act in, I guess I'll say.
Interesting. Yeah. So I like the idea of acting in. I guess it's like whether you acted in a way that was negative towards you inwards.
Yeah, I mean, some of the examples of internalizing symptoms that they give in this paper are anxiety, depression, psychosomatic illness even, whereas the externalizing they defined as more like emotional dysregulation or like oppositional defiant disorder, which is, again, just that rule breaking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Interesting. So they looked at 364 participants, predominantly female, but not that much female. It was 68% female, which is not huge. And then aged 18 to 55 years old. So they really covered the full spectrum.
I do want to say that they excluded co-occurring substance use, which they sort of indicate is kind of a limitation because it resulted in a reduction of externalizing symptoms in the study.
Yeah, interesting. And they looked at, basically, they did a structured interview, according to the DSM. So what else did they look at in terms of how they measured these different externalizing and internalizing ways that we regulate?
Except for the interview, it was all sort of self-report scales, various ones mm-hmm. that they used.
Interesting. Okay. So definitely that limitation then, the self-report scale limitation that we talk about all
the yeah. time. Always the self-report scale limitation. You know, they also sort of mentioned that due to their larger sample size, they couldn't do more of an in-depth analysis on the different variables. But I think really they met the objective of their study, which was mm-hmm. to look at whether or not subtype had any impact on feelings mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. how we portray mm-hmm. them.
Yeah.
How we act in spite yeah. of them.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. So what did they find? And was it a surprise?
Yeah. So they found exactly what they thought they were going to find. mm-hmm. Yeah. So they saw that amongst the hyperactive / impulsive subgroup, strong emotions predicted impulsive actions. Mm-hmm. Whereas mm-hmm. amongst the inattentive subgroup, strong emotions predated strong negative cognitions. So that's sort of that mm-hmm. intrusive thoughts.
Yeah. And this is kind of what we were expecting too. It's hard for me not to say it at the beginning. yeah. Is that, you know, impulsivity. yeah. Impulsivity is related to outward action and inattentiveness. Yeah. You know, hyperactivity is related to outward action, and then inattentiveness is related to more inward action. And that kind of then sort of relates, I guess, in terms of that emotional dysregulation. It's important to recognize these are both emotional dysregulation. These are both affecting people negatively. Yes. It's just that the way that it's being expressed is different, and it occurs along the kind of lines that you would expect. In terms of what that means then for what we know of emotional dysregulation, I mean, I think one of the things that we can say for sure is that it means that there is probably a, you know, I don't want to say 50%, but there's a significant chunk of people that are being missed in diagnosis if the definition of diagnosis for some people is this affecting your outward life? Because according to this study, and it's only one study, there's a strong chance that this isn't going to affect your outward life, at least in terms of emotional regulation.
Yeah, I feel like that's a particular problem for children where we don't actually give them the survey. They're sort of just assessed purely by external means. Mm-hmm. But, you yeah. know, the same thing can happen with sort of adults, you know, oh, there's nothing wrong with you, you're just like me kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, if you're really looking at like, what's the big deal about this study? Mm-hmm. Like, why does it matter? It's really just going to help target treatments that are specific for internalizing versus externalizing symptoms, mm-hmm. and then mean mm-hmm. that depending on the subtype that you're diagnosed with or that you identify with, that's sort of the tried and true method for that. Mm-hmm. Cut out a little bit of that trial and error.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And they did have a few limitations. They mentioned it was a large sample size. They couldn't do a more in-depth analysis, which is unusual. Most people are talking about their small sample sizes, but I guess it's sort of the Goldilocks of sample sizes. You could also have a bit of a struggle with that focus. They also mentioned, as Sarah mentioned before, that they excluded co-occurring substance use in the population, and they thought that this could have resulted in reduced externalizing symptoms because substance abuse or substance use could be a externalizing emotional dysregulation symptom in itself. Which is a good point. It would be interesting to know, but it makes sense as well why they took it out. So there was a couple of interesting quotes here as well. They talked about the idea of, for ADHD, emotional impulsivity is about controlling your emotions, your response to emotionally related and evocative stimuli, and emotional dysregulation involves difficulty down-regulating emotions. So what does that mean in terms of this context, Sarah?
I mean, it sounds to me like they're trying to differentiate between internalizing and externalizing symptoms. But as we already said, sort of emotional dysregulation is, it's just dysregulation, whether it's mm-hmm. affecting the inward or the external.
Yeah.
I guess it makes sense to like conceptualize them differently, because then maybe they can sort of further test them differently, you know, in further research. But it really just sounds like they're trying to distinguish between the two.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And I think, you know, what you said before is really true about the particular interesting information is about if you are the kind of person who has been diagnosed, or you know people who've been diagnosed in childhood, mostly from observational data. And it reminds me of a couple of months ago, we had a paper where the only study of ADHD, or the only sort of subjective reporting of ADHD, was done by a teacher. In which case, based on this study, you could see why any inattentive ADHD would have been missed completely, potentially, which sort of just speaks to the continuing, probably, if we're being honest, underdiagnosis of inattentive ADHD.
I don't remember when or where I was reading this.
I love that stuff.
It was probably a paper for this podcast at some point in time. Mm-hmm. And it was looking at, you know, there's sort of a greater percentage of ADHDers in a clinical setting compared to Gen Pop. And they were saying that amongst the general population, it's still, the prevalence is still estimated at about 3%. And I just think that's low. I think it's wrong, is what I'm saying.
You're calling them out.
I think that research like this, focusing on some of that internal stuff, is really going to help pull out those people. And then, of course, accepting when someone says, hey, I think I have ADHD, and not just being like, oh, stay off TikTok.
I love how you say it like that. I'm like trying to picture the person with that voice. Yeah, no, definitely. And it is, you know, it is more likely. I mean, the first thing we talk about when we talk about ADHD, you know, the first thing that comes to mind often is people going like, oh, no, you don't sound like you have ADHD. And that might be because you have inattentive presenting ADHD. It might just be because that person doesn't know you very well, but it also might be because you have inattentive presenting ADHD. And as a result, yes, it doesn't present. It's really, most of it's happening in your brain, basically.
We know that ADHD can feel overwhelming and frustrating, and that's on a good day. And we don't want anyone to have to navigate that alone.
That's why we created the ADHD Academy, where adults with ADHD can meet, join, share stories, and support each other in a judgment-free way. If you want to connect with others who truly understand you and learn research-based strategies to help you feel more in control and build momentum in your life and work, you found the right place.
Together, let's transform your ADHD challenges into strengths. If you'd like to know more, you can click the link below to join us in the ADHD Academy.
Hope to see you there. Which leads us to our second paper. So we have some practical implications, but we are going to put those in at the end because these papers are so similar. But basically, the second paper kind of builds on this a little bit. It talks about coping with emotional dysregulation among young adults with ADHD. It's a mixed method study of self-awareness and strategies in daily life. And it's definitely a mixed methods. There was like two or three things going on here. You wrote, this one is a lot in your comments.
Everything, everywhere, all at once.
Yeah, seriously. But it was interesting. And what they did was basically wanted to know, how do ADHD symptoms relate to emotional dysregulation? So very similar in that way to the last one. But also, how does being aware of emotional dysregulation and having strategies to improve that affect your day-to-day coping? So if you realize you're emotionally dysregulated, does that help you be less emotionally dysregulated? Which is a really good question that I wanted to know the answer to. So how did they do this study, Sarah?
Well, they took a very robust way of getting there. I feel like we're going to have to talk about this one in parts, you know, sort of the qualitative stuff and the quantitative stuff and all of that. But first, we'll just talk about the methodology, you know, the population. Mm-hmm. So the sample was 60 adults, all sort of within 18 to 33 years old, and 47% male. So, you know, skewed fairly young, but relatively even gender. And they all had an ADHD diagnosis by a medical professional.
Yes. So that's sort of solving that problem right there in terms of diagnostics.
Yeah, exactly. And they also gave them the ADHD self-report scale. And you had to not only have the medical diagnosis, but also score over the clinical threshold on the self-report scale.
Okay. So by all non-neurological definitions, these people had ADHD.
Yes, definitely. I would say they did. Now I'm going to take you through the flow chart of sort of how the study unfolded. So first, they recruited these people and they did the baseline questionnaire. Again, that was the ADHD self-report scale. If they hit the over clinical threshold, then they were invited for what they call the self-regulation skills interview. Now, this was an in-person structured interview led by trained professionals, and it really wants to get at, can you describe self-regulation and how it impacts daily life? And then they sent these people off. They had them download an app. And for 5 times a day for a week, they sent them notifications asking them to check in on how their ADHD symptoms are going. How calm do I feel? Are you feeling focused right now? Things like that. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what they did was really interesting because, again, that questionnaire in the moment, those things on the app, similar to the previous app, that was a self-destruct. So you had to do it in 15 minutes or else it disappeared. So it was very much, very in the moment how you feel right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the interval between which they would send you notifications would vary. So it was anywhere between an hour and like 3 hours apart. And yeah, you had to be quite responsive. But it turned out that that worked as they collected 93% of the data they attempted to collect.
Yeah, we've been talking about this actually as a side note, the idea that, and let me know, you know, if you guys want to let us know whether this would work for you, but the idea of having something that's like you have to respond in the next 15 minutes or this is going to disappear and it's for a week might have provided enough dopamine to get those kind of high response rates compared to, say, filling out a questionnaire once a day. That's sort of a 10-minute questionnaire. I can imagine that being ignored. At least
could you imagine just getting a notification that was like, attention, your coaching note will self-destruct in 15 minutes. You know what? I'll record that sound clip if you think it'll be helpful. So like, let us know in the email.
Yeah. Well, look, we're all we do like most of the week is think about ways to make things work better and people do things more with ADHD. So this was very interesting to me in terms of an interesting strategy.
So then they took the data from the ADHD symptom scale and the sort of in the moment ADHD symptoms, and they did a quantitative analysis on that. Basically, again, they were looking for any correlations between ADHD symptoms reported at baseline and sort of if they remained that way sort of over the week. You know, they were looking for variability.
They really, I don't know, it was like they didn't believe ADHD. They were like, you've gotten diagnosed by it, you know, but we need to do a scale. And now we also need to do, which I completely understand, but it is funny. It's like at every stage, they were like, haha, not ADHD.
And then they took the information from that in-depth interview and they coded it into a thematic analysis to sort of see if there were like stages of awareness of emotional dysregulation. So that was a really cool finding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. Okay. Everyone take a deep breath. We've reached the end of what they did.
Yeah. Now we're going to get into it.
We've done it. We've done great. We did spend an extra like 10 minutes or so being like, what did they do before we came on here? So tell us, Sarah, what did they find in this amazing study?
So first I'll talk about some of the quantitative stuff. So when they looked at awareness scores of emotional dysregulation and strategic behavior awareness, so basically the self-regulation interview, they saw that on average, their participants had relatively high awareness of their emotional dysregulation and sort of coping strategies. So that was awesome. They also found that the self-regulation awareness and strategic behavior dimensions, sort of variables, were strongly correlated with one another. So basically that means that if you struggle with implementing coping strategies, you're also more likely to struggle with an awareness that you are experiencing emotional dysregulation.
Okay.
And the opposite is true. If you're more aware that you're experiencing emotional dysregulation, then you'll probably be more successful with implementing strategic coping skills to meet that need.
Yeah. Okay. And you have to assume that part of that is because if you're aware that you struggle with emotional dysregulation, you're also building some kind of strategies to support it.
Yeah. Even finding out what doesn't work is going to give you information here.
Yeah. So I guess what they found was that knowing you have struggles with emotional regulation was sort of the first factor in being able to support your emotional dysregulation, which people with ADHD often struggle with.
Yeah, they actually get into that a little bit more in their thematic analysis, which we'll get to in a moment. There is one more quantitative finding here, and it doesn't come from the retrospective ADHD symptoms. That really was just extra information. It didn't have any correlations with the self-regulation scores. However, ADHD symptom lability, which means like a wider range of symptoms, predicted a significant correlation with a lower self-awareness, which essentially means that if you experience a wider range of ADHD symptoms or that that changes quite frequently day to day, then it's going to be a lot harder to sort of have an awareness around what specifically is triggering you.
Yeah, that's interesting. So do they mean that like if you feel like in terms of if we talk about executive functioning, right? Because that's kind of what ADHD is. If you have some days where you feel like your executive functioning is really good and some days where you feel like it's very not good and that varies over time, you're also more likely to struggle with recognizing emotional dysregulation.
That is what the paper suggests. It was sort of a moderate significant correlation, so it wasn't extremely high or anything. But essentially what I think is going on here is greater presentation of ADHD symptoms indicates greater dysregulation.
Interesting.
Period. So let's look at the thematic analysis from the self-regulation skills interview, because essentially it charts out the three stages of awareness of emotional dysregulation, at least, you know, amongst the people that they talk to, right? So we have three themes and eight sub-themes. We're really only going to get crazy about the three main themes because they're so cool. The first one is they called emergent awareness. And that essentially means that this participant is beginning to notice emotional dysregulation pop up in their life.
So what would that be an example of? So somebody's starting to notice, can you give me kind of a example of what that would look like? So person A is doing what during the day that would make them in this category?
Yeah, I mean, maybe person A goes to the bathroom to get away from their desk for a little while and just starts crying in the bathroom at work. And this person notices that this is happening and they're like, okay, cool. I'm experiencing emotional dysregulation in my life.
That is such an accurate
and then there's also like a yes, no situation, right? Because people at this stage, you're going to test them for it and they're either going to have an awareness or they're not.
Yeah. Okay.
So that's sort of the first step.
That's the first step, right? Okay. So what's the next step?
So the next step is anticipatory awareness. That essentially means that the participant is starting to get an awareness around their triggers for emotional dysregulation.
Right.
So maybe this person knows that, I don't know, they don't like the printer that is right behind their desk and it's just driving them absolutely crazy. Yeah, it's loud. There's always people standing behind them. And so the reason why they went to the bathroom is because, you know, this person always comes at this time of day. And so that's the participant starting to understand their triggers.
It's funny. This sounds like a ridiculous example, but it does remind me of back in the day when I worked in one of those bullpen style open offices. And the printer was really annoying because it would suddenly start from nowhere and print heaps of stuff out and just distract you from whatever you were doing. So yeah, I relate to this person.
And then sort of the last stage of this all is the strategic behavior stage. So This participant has a plan to work on themselves. You know, this person has a good working understanding of what coping strategies and grounding strategies work for them when they're experiencing emotional dysregulation. Yes, they have earplugs. They soundproof their cubicle. No, that's an unrealistic suggestion.
They've maybe asked if they can be moved to a different part of the office. You know,
that's a great real life suggestion.
Yeah. Music, earplugs. Maybe they are doing some kind of grounding routine, which we'll talk about in a minute. That would be person three.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And you can really see how like each of these steps build off of each other and get to a point where you can feel more in control of the dysregulation. Even if you can't necessarily control the original response to the stimulus.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think it's a really nice little example of that. You know, whereas the first one we're looking at, you know, how does this emotional dysregulation present in different groups, ADHD inattentive versus ADHD hyperactive, this one goes into a bit more depth around if you're aware of your dysregulation, no matter how it presents, is that sort of helping you to then work on it? And it's nice that the answer is yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, we also know just sort of from the ADHD planning space that taking the time to identify a plan before you try jumping in is just going to make executing that plan so much easier. So if you're already experiencing emotional dysregulation, if you logically know what your plan is, you can just focus your energy on executing that plan instead of going like, gosh, do I want to watch dog videos or cat videos today? I can't decide. And now you're crying because you can't decide.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's, you know, I think we sound just, you know, for the audience's perspective, you know, we're laughing because this is all highly relatable content to our lives. It might not be cat or dog videos, but, you know, emotional dysregulation is something that we all struggle with ADHD most of the time. That's becoming really evident. And it's nice to see this research to discuss that and just discuss how we can support ourselves.
Yeah. And I also really loved that this thematic analysis allowed you to like be somewhere on each of these scales, like at the same time. Like, you know, obviously you have to be at least somewhat aware that you're experiencing emotional dysregulation in order to do anything about it. But apart from that, you can sort of exist anywhere in a combination of these. You know, maybe you're trying strategies, but they're not super effective, but that's okay because you're still trying them every time you get that one specific trigger.
Yeah.
And eventually you'll strike on something that does work and it'll all be like,
And they, you know, in this paper, they did talk a little bit about the importance of letting people pick their own dysregulation strategies, which I thought was really lovely. We had Whitney on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, and, you know, she talked about the idea of yoga and like picking your own kind of yoga. Do you want to do like relaxing yoga or hot yoga or aerial yoga or whatever it is, you know? And this is sort of a similar thing where it's like not every system is going to work for everyone in every situation.
Yeah. And honestly, this paper even suggests that just the practice of trying something and then sort of self-monitoring whether or not it worked is a method of enhancing self-awareness, you know, because you're intentionally breaking out that time to look at whether or not this thing had the specific outcome you desired. And it's giving you that moment to sort of think about all those spaces and time, you know, that you might not have otherwise if you weren't looking at whether or not showering before bed affected the quality of your sleep.
Exactly. Yeah. No, it was good. Like, we like this paper. Shout out to the people who made this. This is a very cool little look into something that a couple of years ago, people didn't even recognize was associated with ADHD. So how the turntables have turned. Do you want to take us through a little bit now, some of those skills? Now that we've spent ages talking about the benefits of ADHD skills and grounding and things like that, what are some things that people can say? They're like, okay, I want to be aware of my dysregulation. And now, do you have any advice on how to do that?
Yeah. So if you are at the stage where you don't yet know that physical sensations can be associated with emotions, that might be a good place to start. Sometimes, you know, neurodiversity happens with alexithymia, which is like not experiencing emotions in a neurotypical fashion. Not really sure I understand it completely, but it can really explain some of that disconnect between neurodiverse people and like their awareness of their body, I think. Anyway, so if you're there, then perhaps looking at like a feeling sensation wheel might be helpful to identify, to start picking out like, oh, every time my palms are sweaty, it's because I'm nervous. Or every time my chest pounds in this one specific spot, it's because I'm worried my mom hasn't called me all day.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, but again, building in those moments to sort of be self-reflective intentionally can help to build that habit. When you do start feeling things, then you can sort of be like, oh, now I'm more responsive.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, actually. You know, another example of this, and again, I'm not an expert on alexithymia either, but another example of this is, you know, realizing, you know, if I get stressed about what to eat for dinner, it's because I'm feeling overwhelmed at my life, not about dinner. Like there might be some kind of triggers in that way as well, not just in terms of in your body, but also in terms of like the things that you focus on as a coping mechanism for the emotion that you're not acknowledging.
Yeah, sort of projecting your frustration onto your dinner. Absolutely. Yeah. That makes so much sense.
So those are all examples. And, you know, in order to focus on those, we talk about mindfulness a lot. And this is just another example of, at some point, unfortunately, you do have to have a mindful moment in order to acknowledge that, understand what's going on. So trying to make that mindful moment as simple as possible, whether it's I brush my teeth and I have a mindful moment, I wash my dishes and I have a mindful moment, I sit in the grass and I have a mindful moment, like whatever you can do is helpful.
Mine is in the shower. 10 minutes goes by and it feels like 3 hours. It's wonderful.
100%.
So great.
Mine is currently brushing my teeth, which is why I use that example. Brushing my teeth is a great way to add a little new habit that I'm trying to build. Because theoretically, we always have to brush our teeth.
It's so hard to carve out time for yourself when you have a newborn.
Yes. Yeah.
Granting
you grace. Newborn cannot. My newborn cannot bug me when I'm brushing my teeth. I have to do it. So yeah, there are these kind of little spaces. And in terms of then the kinds of exercises you can do, we've talked about, you know, we're not therapists. So if this is a serious focus for you, definitely recommend talking to a therapist and connecting with someone in that space. But there are exercises you can do, body scans, three things you can hear, three things you can see, three things you can smell, those kinds of exercises as well as super practical ones like, this is a trigger for me. Okay. Let's bring headphones or ask to move to a different part of the office. Like there's also very practical things you can do if the emotional dysregulation is related to something that is a sensory issue, for example, or an overwhelm issue, which can often be connected to ADHD struggles.
Yeah, definitely. If you can accommodate yourself around sort of some of those triggers, those sensory triggers, absolutely, 100% recommend. Find the spot in the office where the fluorescent light just doesn't work and make that your spot.
Yeah, 100%. By the way, this is an interesting question about the fluorescent lights. I'm going to go off on a tangent, but the idea that you can hear fluorescent lights. Can you hear fluorescent lights or is that just me? I've heard people can not hear them. Like they make a little whining sound.
I feel like I don't even know what a fluorescent light is anymore. Because we just had like the LEDs for so long, but yes, I've also heard other people say that they can hear sort of electricity and then other people minimize that and be like, you just have tinnitus. So, no, but this is different.
Yeah. There's a whole,
it's definitely a phenomenon. Yeah. neurodivergent mm-hmm. sensory experiences are wild. And one day we will be validated for our experiences. I hold the hope.
Yeah. Yeah, I wasn't sure about that. I agree with you, LED lights and things like that. But I can definitely, like, those old school fluorescent lights when they like blink, you know, that you turn them on and they take a minute to like blink on. I used to work in very old university buildings. Those things are very loud. So yeah, validation for people who are hearing this.
But do you remember when cell phones were sort of new, and if you were getting a call or a text message and your phone was right next to the computer, it would sort of be like, I can't even do it, but it would like groan.
I do remember that.
It would be like, T-t-t-t-t-t-t-t-t.
I remember that. Yeah, you would know you were getting a text message because your electricity would kind of fritz a little bit, like your like computer and things like that.
Yeah. I mean, so theoretically, like maybe.
yeah. No, that is very true. Gosh, we've just opened a whole can of worms.
Yeah, that was definitely not the tangent that I was expecting to go down.
This is with everybody in your life, what you can hear versus what they can hear.
Yeah.
You're welcome. But yeah, so definitely in terms of these areas, yeah, acknowledging it, figuring out what tools you can use, building mm-hmm. those tools, like these are practical, mm-hmm. helpful things. And the research mm-hmm. in this case backs it up. These are practical, helpful things to do.
Figuring out what specific strategy works in what specific situation. You know, mm-hmm. when we're looking at dopamine pairings, I would never suggest that you put on music while you're trying to listen to your online class, you know, but I might suggest you put on music if you're trying to fold laundry, you know? So like, if you're struggling with intrusive thoughts, I'm not going to tell you to do an internal mindfulness exercise. I'm going to be like, that's go outside and wait there until you hear 10 different animals, and then you can go inside.
Yeah. Go on a walk. I love a walk for those kinds of, I think my ADHD is hyperactive. So I do a lot of like, okay, that was a lot. And I have a lot of thoughts. And now I'm going to go on a walk and kind of talk and share and with my partner and kind of like share and get all that energy out. And that's quite quite a helpful way of like grounding in a way. It's like an active form of grounding. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Cool. Well, yeah, two very interesting papers. It's really great to talk about emotional dysregulation. Like I said, when I first started learning about it, mostly people were like, oh yeah, that thing that probably isn't related. It's still not in the DSM, but the research continues to pile up. So I'm sure it will be there soon. Well, we will see you all back here in 2 weeks for another interesting paper. We have a few that we've tabled because we're going to try and talk to a psychiatrist or someone thereabouts. And yeah, we'll see what we find in the new and upcoming research next time. See you later. Thanks for listening. If you'd like to reach out or connect with us, you can leave us a message at admin@unconventionalorganization.com.
You can also find out more about our ADHD coaching organization, read our free articles, or sign up to our online courses at unconventionalorganization.com. That's organization with a Z or an S. They both will get you there.
If you'd like to learn more about what we discussed here today, or you want to read the transcript, you can find that at our show notes page at unconventionalorganization.com.
If you've enjoyed this podcast and think someone else might find the strategies and stories helpful, the best thing you can do is share episodes using the share button in the podcast player, or leave a 5-star review on Apple or Spotify or your podcast player of choice, letting them know why you've benefited from this podcast.
Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you back in the ADHD lab next week.